All right, well, thank you for coming here today. And I know it's Friday late afternoon, so I expected to see about 5 people. But I see actually quite a few more, and that's good news. So I'm very happy that you guys had the stamina to show up before retiring for the weekend. So I would like to tell you about some work which we've been doing, which originated with the work on disordered bile fermions, but eventually expanded into something bigger, trying to understand some aspects of single particle disorder problem which go beyond what you normally read in textbooks, even though you seem like, well, this seemed like to be a very well-established field, and you don't hear a lot about research about single particle disorder physics. These days, people talk about many-body disorder physics, many-body localization. And there's going to be the whole program at KTP in a couple of months on many-body localization. And if you don't work on many-body localization, you're behind the times, and you just keep producing something which is well-known. But it turns out that there is still some interesting questions, even in single particle disorder physics, which is worth addressing. And that's what I'll tell you about today. So this work, which I'll describe, was done in collaboration with Leo Radzihovsky and with Sergei Cizeronov, who was really the driving force of this entire work. If he wasn't there, it would not have been done. Oh, look, some guests coming in. So I need to mention his name just so that he's not forgotten. And I will also write down some of the references which discuss this. So paper, PLD, 114, 91, 035, 133. So that one talks about some of the issues which I'll discuss today, having to do with high dimensional localization. And then there is also PRB 92, 041, 406, 2015, and finally there's a PRL 114, 166, 601. All of these papers are in 2015, even though some of them are in the archive in 2014. Okay, so now that I gave you a list of references, I can just go straight into the subject, and I'd like to start by telling you that originally, our interest in this set of problems arose when we started looking into the problem of disordered vial semimetals. And we all here know what vial semimetals are. So we imagine that a Hamiltonian, which I don't have to explain, which looks like some kind of velocity multiplied by the sum over 3 Pauli matrices, each of which coupled to the corresponding momentum. And so the Hamiltonian, as written here, would be a Hamiltonian of a single wild node, where sigma I are Pauli matrices. But I imagine that I add to this Hamiltonian a random potential. And I can actually imagine more than one type of randomness, but I'll consider a potential which simply depends, well, it's not a matrix, it's proportional to the identity matrix, and just depends on the position. So scalar potential without any internal structure having to do with these Pauli matrices. And this will be the conventional Quine's disorder, short-range correlated. So I imagine that this correlator goes as lambda multiplied by some kind of three-dimensional delta function of x minus y. So x and y are three-dimensional coordinates, since we're in three-dimensional space. So this problem looks somewhat like the conventional Schrodinger equation with random potential, which has been studied by many people. But it has some new structure. It has some Pauli matrices, linear and derivative instead of being quadratic and derivatives. And so it turns out that it has a whole variety of different features not present in disordered Schrodinger equation. And historically, this problem was first studied by Eduardo Frotkin in 1986 in a rather interesting paper. So he, that was in the early days of Anderson localization and related studies. I mean, at that point, people already understood Anderson localization, but still, these were still hotly debated issues, I would say. But so what Frotkin observed, though, in 1986, that unlike the conventional Schrödinger equation, these problems seem to have special critical value of disorder, at which a variety of new critical phenomena are observed, which have nothing to do with Anderson localization, some kind of new types of critical phenomena. And so after he wrote his paper, it was kind of forgotten, maybe, because not that many people were interested in this problem, until it was revived essentially very recently because of all these proposals of wild cell metals and recent experimental discovery of these systems, for which this Hamiltonian is a good description, which may be disordered, in which case you want to understand the property of this Hamiltonian. And so many people went back to Frotkin's work and reread it and improved on it. And the main claim of that paper, that there is a special critical value of disorder at which interesting things start happening, it still stands as of right now. So maybe some of the detailed calculations which were done in that paper have since been improved significantly, but not the main claim. The claim was correct. And so then when we started working on the subject, we ourselves got interested in this claim of the critical disorder and what it really means. But we quickly realized that the claim that there is a critical disorder in this problem has nothing to do with its Dirac-ness or wildness or complicated structure you have here. It has to do with the fact that you're above certain upper critical dimension for the problem of particles with linear dispersion perturbed by some kind of disorder. And it turns out that in any kind of problem, even in conventional Schrödinger equation, you can define the analog of such upper critical dimension. And what's interesting is that nobody has ever introduced the concept of upper critical dimension in the Schrödinger problem. People always say that as long as you're above two dimensions, you'll have Anderson localization, and that's it. There's nothing special about going through some upper critical dimension. But it turns out that this problem has an upper critical dimension. It just was somehow either overlooked or not really looked at seriously. And so we also very quickly realized that studying Schrödinger equation and what the implications of these upper critical dimensions are for the Schrödinger equation is much simpler than studying these wild problem, because it doesn't have these Pauli matrices and all this complicated structure. It's a much simpler problem, which people studied in the past as well. And so we decided to look at the disordered Schrödinger equation in the high enough dimension. So it turns out that for the Dirac problem, high enough dimension means you should be in dimensional space above 2. And so for three-dimensional wild problem, you are above 2. But for Schrödinger equation, you should be in dimensional space above 4. In order to see this kind of physics. So 4 will be the upper critical dimension. Mm-hmm. Yes. And people probably were not particularly interested in the Schrödinger equation in dimension above 4 because it's too abstract. Our real world is three-dimensional. But we know that sometimes high-dimensional problems map into other problems which live in lower number of dimensions. So for example, high-dimensional disordered Schrödinger equation maps into a problem of Kick-Rotor, which is zero-dimensional and can be realized with cold atoms, has already been realized with cold atoms, although they work specifically at three-dimensional Schrödinger equation. And so these kind of equations are accessible to experiment, and they're useful to look at on their own merit. Although, as I said, some of the stuff we'll learn then translates into the wild problem, which is already in high enough dimensions in three dimensions. So to make our life easier, I'm going to talk about Schrödinger equation. And if I have time left, I'll talk a little bit about the implication for the wild fermions moving in disorder potential. Partially because Schrödinger equation is easier to understand and we'll know a lot more about it to begin with so that I can compare this with what is already known. So let's look, instead of looking at the wild problem, let's look at the Schrödinger problem. So I imagine that I have particles, non-interacting particles, obeying the Hamiltonian, which looks like 1 over 2m, maybe minus Laplacian, plus disorder potential. It's the same disorder potential as here. But I imagine that this happens, let's say, in d dimensions. So v is correlated onto d-dimensional delta function now, instead of three dimensions. So let's write here d dimensions So there's no questions about us being in particular number of dimensions. Now, let's recall what we know about this problem in three dimensions. So one thing which people sometimes study is the density of states of this problem. In fact, that's one of the first things which people study. So density of states is defined, as you know, as 1 over volume multiplied by the sum over all energy levels of energy minus these energy levels. So it's a function of E, and that is averaged over disorder. So I'll put these brackets to signify averaging over disorder. And so this density of states has been studied for disorder Schrodinger equation in dimensions 1, 2, 3, but as it turns out, not above 4. So something happens to this density of states, which people didn't really study until now. But let's look at three-dimensional case, or actually any D less than 4, which is the conventional case. So how does this density of states look? Well, people know that for large negative energies, the density of states decreases exponentially, and then it increases, and then it starts growing. So the growth at large positive energy occurs roughly as if there is no disorder. If energy is high enough, who cares that there is disorder around? And so then the density of states goes proportionally to energy to the power of d over 2 minus 1. So in this particular picture, I imagine d is 3, because if d is 1, for example, it actually goes down. It's 1 over square root of e. And now here, density of states goes to 0 exponentially, according to the law, well, known to be, well, this density of states called Lifshitz tails, that states which occur at large negative value of energy. And so Lifshitz tail obey this rough formula. So it's energy to the power of 2 minus d over 2 here. What's interesting that if you look at the form of how these exponentially decays for large negative energies, clearly something happens to this form when d becomes larger than 4. But if you look at all the papers on the subject, they never discuss what happens to it when d is larger than 4. Some of the papers actually do mention, I want d to be less than 4. Some of the papers don't even mention this. But already that equation hints at something new happening at large negative dimensions. I mean, sorry, at dimensions larger than 4.
So clearly, this Lifshitz tail is a rare event argument, right?
Right.
We look at very rare configuration of the potential with very negative things and estimate the probability. That's how it comes from.
That's right. Yes. And that's where this comes from, this estimate. Okay, so that's how density of states looks like. Now, but people, in addition to density of states, also like to look at the localization length. So eigenstates of this problem are known to be to have finite extent in space, and they're called localized in that case. But at high enough energy, they're delocalized and do not have finite extent in space. And so people typically plot this graph. That's the, let me see. I'm going to plot what is called mobility H as a function of disorder strength. So this will be zero for both energy and disorder strength, but disorder strength is positive by definition, it's at lambda. And so mobility H.
Can I follow up on Antoine's question? Just
yes.
And since it comes from the tail of the distribution, that exponential, I guess, it's not really universal. It depends on the specific form.
Right. It depends on this being Gaussian distribution. That's
not
true.
Not properties of the center of the distribution.
Right. So I should maybe say that I'm looking at the Gaussian distribution of phi. There will be some corrections to what I'll say if distribution deviates from Gaussian distribution, but I think it'll be clear from what I'll say.
Well, one thing,
yes,
right,
this is Gaussian.
If the distribution of B is bounded, then the spectrum is bounded. So
right, yes. Okay. Then it's then the spectrum is bounded. There's still Lifshitz tails.
Yeah,
they describe how you approach that bound.
Not
right?
Like infinity.
But I'm looking at a random Gaussian distribution. Okay, and so there is something called mobility H, which is known numerically to have this shape, actually dips below zero for Gaussian distribution, and then increases, such that for energies below these energies, below this mobility H, all the states here are localized, and these states are all delocalized. So these states have finite extent in space, and these states have infinite extent, and as you approach the mobility H, by increasing the energy, localization length diverges, and it's known to diverge according to some law, 1 over e mobility, which is a function of lambda, minus e to the power, which I'm going to call Anderson critical exponent, nu Anderson. It's known that nu Anderson does not depend on lambda. So you can vary your lambda any way you want, but no matter what your lambda is, as you increase your energy, eventually you hit the mobility edge, and this divergence is controlled by the same critical exponent, no matter what lambda is. Okay. So all of this is known so well that it's just take it for granted these days. You read about this in textbooks. But what is less appreciated, and what we described in one of our papers given over there, is that if you're above 4 dimensions, these pictures change. And since my time is limited and I'm using the blackboard, let me first tell you exactly what changes. And then I'll describe for you why it changes and what it implies if there is time for Weil fermions. Okay, so let me describe now what happens with these pictures if I go to dimensions above 4, maybe 5 dimensions. Suppose d is larger than 4. So it turns out that as d becomes larger than 4, this problem acquired a special critical disorder strength, lambda critical. And something unusual happens when lambda is equal to lambda critical. So lambda critical does not exist above, below 4 dimensions, only exists above 4 dimensions. And so if I fix lambda to be lambda critical, the density of states as a function of energy is no longer a smooth curve. So this curve is smooth, and it doesn't have any kind of singularities along the line. It has nothing to do with localization transition. So, for example, if energy is equal to the mobility edge, nothing special happens to the density of states, as everybody knows. But here, when lambda is equal to lambda critical, density of states acquires roughly the following qualitative form. It has some kind of tail, similar to Lipschitz tail, up to the point, which I'll call EC, some kind of critical value of energy. At this value of energy, density of states has a cusp. So it's its derivative is not continuous. And you can describe this cusp by a formula that rho is given by some smooth function of E plus some contribution, which looks like E minus EC to the power of D over Z minus 1, where Z is some kind of new type of critical exponent, which wasn't appreciated in the context of this other Schrodinger equation before, but it was appreciated in this context before, going back to Frotkin, but not in this context. And so you can see that this clearly provides for some kind of discontinuity in the derivative of this rho. Okay, so that's the behavior of the density of states. It has this singularity. By the way, nobody has ever seen this numerically, because nobody seriously studied disordered Schrodinger equation above 4 dimensions. All the existing studies are, well, they're either below 4 dimensions, or actually there are studies above 4 dimensions, but those studies don't look at low enough energies. They look at fairly high energies. Typically, they have some kind of band, and they look at the middle of the band. This EC will be close to the bottom of the band somewhere, and these energies were just not studied. So that's one. I'll separate this from D equals 3 case. So that's one new feature, discontinuous density of states. The other new feature occurs if we look at the mobility edge.
Sorry, what if lambda is less than lambda C, but greater than 0?
Then it'll be smooth.
And lambda greater than lambda C?
Also smooth. It only has a singularity when lambda is equal to lambda C. So you need to tune lambda to lambda C. So actually, lambda minus lambda C is a relevant perturbation for this problem. And that's how eventually you justify this picture.
Sorry, what's a physical interpretation of the singularity here?
Well, I'll discuss this later. I want first to give the result. I just want to describe what changes.
Victor?
And then I'll discuss why it changes.
Sorry to interrupt with questions, but there were studies on the Anderson problem, the localization problem on the tree, right? By Mielin and, well, it started with Fowler and others. And this thing doesn't happen then?
So we thought about this. We think this does not happen there. That K scalar tree is some kind of infinite dimensional problem, and so it's some sort of a special limit.
Not exactly, because of course, in infinite connectivity there is no Anderson transition, but in any finite connectivity there is. So it doesn't have loops, but it's not exactly.
Yes. There is actually some recent study of localization problem on Cayley tree, which claim to see some new types of transitions. There is a chance that maybe this is related to what I'm describing, but my understanding is that these studies are controversial. There's no complete agreement on what they mean or whether this transition even happens, and so I'm just not in the position to comment on these studies.
Is that the Scarluccio papers that you're referring to? Uh-huh. Which studies are you referring to now?
There's at least one archive paper by Biroli and collaborators who identified two transitions. And then I think there's some follow-up papers. But anyway, that goes way beyond what I would like to talk about. But I can, if you like, I can give you references later.
I didn't get it.
Yes?
The mobility edges lie below EC, above EC, it doesn't matter. It can be either way.
Mobility H is where?
If I ask if lambda is equal to lambda C, where does the mobility...
I haven't plotted it yet.
Right.
I'm about to start plotting it.
Okay.
So how about I plot it?
Yes.
Okay. I was about to plot mobility H, but didn't get to it. So, the main new feature of the mobility edge as a function of disorder strength is that it's no longer a smooth function. It actually has a discontinuity in its derivative at lambda equal to lambda c. So exactly how mobility edge goes on the way how I know it here. So for example, here I know that it dips below zero from numerical studies from 1980s. That's how mobility edge goes. Here I actually don't know exactly how mobility edge goes, except I know there is a point, lambda equal to lambda c, at which point the mobility edge is equal to EC. That same EC, which I identified over there. So it hits the point EC at lambda c, and then it has a discontinuity in its derivative as it goes through this point. And this discontinuity can be described by the formula in the vicinity of lambda c, that EM of lambda is equal to some smooth function E naught M of lambda plus, again, some constant, I don't know, different from that constant, some C tilde times lambda minus lambda C. And here I'll identify a new critical exponent called nu. So altogether are two critical exponents, nu and z, which control the EC lambda C point. Ultimately, because I have to tune two parameters to tune to this point, lambda to lambda c and e to ec. And so that would be the singularity in the mobility edge. And finally, now that I identified how mobility edge goes, I can tell you how Anderson transition happens if I fix this order and I tune through the mobility edge. So if I fix this order at value stronger than lambda c, I will go through a conventional Anderson transition with localization link diverging as EM of lambda minus E to some power, which I'll call nu Anderson, but it's, every number of dimension has its own nu Anderson. But the important thing is that this nu Anderson is lambda independent, as long as it's larger than lambda C. So all of these lambdas, I tune my E, I will go through the transition controlled by the same exponent. And that's the conventional transition. Usually when people say, yes, five-dimensional Anderson localization is just like three-dimensional Anderson localization. There is some sigma model, has some critical points, which describes this new A. And it turns out it only applies when lambda is larger than lambda C. But when lambda is equal to lambda C, you get a different behavior. So localization link will diverge as 1 over EC minus E. So EM of lambda C is EC, and I'll write it here to emphasize this. And so EC minus E to the power 1 over Z. Didn't write it here, but it should be 1 over Z. Where Z is the same critical exponent which appears in these two formulas. So in principle, if you know this and that, it could be a non-trivial check that localization length diverges with the same z, which you extract from here and here. So that's the new universality class of Anderson transition, which wasn't really discussed before.
Lambda
less
than lambda?
Yeah, I was going to.
Yes. Right, I'm coming to it. But I have to admit that I do not have a good answer to this question. So what happens when lambda is less than lambda c? I have various guesses, but I don't know. All I know that there should be some kind of transition. What happens to localization length as you tune through it here? Basically, the tools I have at my disposal are insufficient to give me an answer. I have various hand-waving arguments, but they're not all in agreement with each other. Because of this, I don't want to make any predictions. And actually, I invite you to think about this problem, about what happens when lambda is less than lambda c.
Are you suggesting that if I use the sigma model approach, then I cannot obtain this result?
Yes. So we think that sigma model will only apply if lambda is larger than lambda c. And if lambda is less than lambda c, you will not be able to do anything with sigma model. It just doesn't capture the right physics.
So when you approach lambda c, does the exponents don't match, like, and get confused?
Yes. So there is really a crossover phenomenon here, which is if lambda is close to lambda c, but is bigger than lambda c, then if you are far enough from the mobility edge, you will see this exponent. But as you get very close, you will see this exponent, and you can write down crossover function.
Okay.
That.
Can I ask also about the, you say localization length? One can talk about, usually in disordered systems, we talk about two lengths, mean free path and localization length. So is everywhere in your space of E and lambda the mean free path finite?
Yes, that's a very good question. Because this transition manifests itself in the density of states, we actually think that mean free path diverges at this point.
Well, but not below.
What? Not?
But not at any energy for lambda less than lambda c?
Not at any energy for lambda less than lambda c. So that's a little counterintuitive. And I don't have a good explanation for that. Except all I can tell you is that if lambda is equal to lambda c, the field theory, which describes this other average single particle Green's function, has a critical point. So it has a divergent length. There's no question that single particle disorder average Green's functions is long range. And if it's long range, well, it cannot be compatible with short, you know, with mean free path being finite.
Yeah, I mean, so the naive guess might have been that as you, I don't know if it's, that it doesn't seem to agree with what you're saying, but if I start with lambda small, so less than lambda c, lambda's irrelevant perturbation to the holistic critical point, which is just the free particle of zero energy. And so you would think that for lambda less than c, lambda c on approaching zero energy, maybe it renormalizes a little bit as a function of energy, as a function of lambda, there would be a diverging mean free path.
So you mean if lambda is less than lambda c, mean free path will be infinity?
At some particular energy.
At some particular energy, it will be infinite. Well, the thing is that you can actually calculate mean free path for weak lambda simply by direct perturbation theory. And you get some answer which doesn't seem to be infinity. And it's some function of energy. So there's nothing special about this answer. And that's why, at least in this regime, you kind of get the impression that there is just some mean free path, just like in any other problem.
I understand you don't know yet exactly how it behaves in that regime, but are you sure at least that the wave functions are exponentially localized?
In this regime.
For lambda smaller than lambda c. Couldn't it be
yes. So my evidence for the exponential localization of wave functions here for very weak lambda comes from essentially Lipschitz tail analysis. I can look at wave functions at very large negative energy, at energies which are large and negative. And so those states would not be present without disorder, and they have to be generated by large Gaussian disorder. And those states, I think, should be localized. Now, this is somewhat hand-waving argument, but it's hard to argue with this. So that's why I think, at least here somewhere, they're localized. Also, somewhere here, they're localized. So there has to be a mobility age in between, unless there's something fancier happens. I don't know, two mobility ages or something. more complicated, but I don't know. And the simplest scenario would be a single mobility edge. But really, when lambda is less than lambda c, I don't really know what's going on. So I mean, I can only speculate or give hand-waving arguments, but the existence of the mobility edge comes from arguing that there are Lipschitz tail states which are localized. Okay, so I gave you some of the answers, and now I'd like to tell you where these answers come from. Maybe I'll erase the Schrodinger equation here, since I will not talk about three-dimensional Schrodinger equation again. So part of the reason these new pictures have to be invented, which didn't exist below four dimensions, has to do with the fact that disorder is indeed irrelevant at if it's weak, if you are in high enough dimensions. And so in particular, it's relevant for any Dirac-like problems if you're above two dimensions. And it's also irrelevant for Schrodinger equation if you're above four dimensions. So let me quickly tell you why it's irrelevant. Now, there are various hand-waving arguments or qualitative arguments you can give to show that disorder is irrelevant. But I have a limited amount of time, and those arguments are limited in their applicability. So why wouldn't I just give you a field theoretic argument? Well, we're theorists, right? So we're not afraid of field theoretic arguments. So you just write down a theory which describes disorder averaged Green's functions. We can look at disorder averaged single particle Green's functions. So usually, in the context of localization, people say it's not interesting to look at single particle Green's function. But if you're in high enough dimensions, it is already interesting enough to look at disorder averaged single particle Green's functions. So these are disorder averaged expressions of energy minus our Hamiltonian. And that can be computed as some kind of functional integral. But using replicas, for example, or supersymmetry, let me use replicas so that I don't have to write down expressions which are too complicated. So it will be some kind of an integral of this action, I phi bar minus 1 over. Actually, why wouldn't I do one generalization of my problem, where instead of looking at Schrodinger equation with random potential, I look at more general equation, which will have a form of minus I ddx raised to some power alpha plus disorder. So for the Schrodinger problem, alpha is 2. But I'd like to generalize to more general powers. So this is the absolute value of the momentum to the power of alpha. And this is the same random potential I have here. And this will be the kind of problems I will look at. So here I'll have my E minus this guy. And then there is also the result of averaging over disorder, which will look like lambda. So this is replicated, mn, and this will be a, well, that may be aa. This will be a, bar b. The whole thing is integrated. So I think this is the kind of theory which I will write using replicas, which will generate for me this other average Green's function. And so here, of course, I'm summing over a from 1 to n, and here I have two independent sums over a and b from 1 to n. Anybody who worked with disorder knows exactly what I wrote there. Okay, and so we can look at this as a field theory, and we can ask, what does this lambda do under renormalization? And interestingly, you know, when I first studied how you approach random potentials, and when people told me, well, you use replicas, I thought, well, I guess you want to study how this renormalizes, but immediately I was told, no, that's not what you want to do. You want to derive sigma models. And then you can apply a normalization group. But it turns out that it's indeed true if you're below four dimensions, you don't need to think about this renormalization. But above four dimensions, for Schrodinger equation, you have to do this. For Schrodinger, I mean when alpha is 2. More generally, you have to be in dimensionality of space above 2 alpha. And that follows from the following renormalization group equations. By the way, when I was preparing these notes, I realized that I wrote this as a derivative with respect to L, which is a logarithm of my scale, and I already have L used up for localization length, but this is the only place where L appears, so I hope everybody knows that this is not the localization length, which is the usual renormalization group equations. And so the first term in this renormalization group equation can be extracted almost immediately by looking at dimensions of terms here, that's just by dimensional analysis, and it's this term. So it immediately tells us that if D is below 2 alpha, which is below 4 for Schrodinger equation, or below 2 or for Dirac equation, then lambda is relevant. It actually grows on the normalization group. But above 4 dimensions for the Schrodinger equation, above 2 for Dirac, and above 2 alpha more generally for these kind of equations, disorder will grow. Then there is a second term, if you do one loop renormalization group, which actually happens to be positive and looks like this. Now, you could ask me why it's positive, and unfortunately, I don't have a good hand-waving argument or qualitative argument why it has to be positive. It is positive in essentially all the problems you can look at, including this problem. One way of arguing why it has to be positive is to realize that if I flip the sign of lambda, this problem actually maps into self-avoiding random walk problem, something which is very well known, that self-avoiding random walk is a motion and purely imaginary potential, which has negative zero strength. But if you do this, what you'll obtain is essentially conventional Wilson-Fisher renormalization group. And indeed, under lambda goes to minus lambda, this becomes a Wilson-Fisher type of equations for FIFO theory. But here, the sign is opposite, because you have to flip the sign of lambda. And that's how that comes about. There is also a second equation. So the Gaussian fixed point here, which I'd like to consider, it's E equal to 0, lambda equal to 0. So E is also a relevant perturbation, has its own normalization group equations, which generally look like alpha plus some beta lambda times E. So the first term, alpha E, is just, again, dimensional analysis. E must have dimension alpha. But more generally, you generate the next of the term, which is lambda E. OK, so now if you look at these equations, you immediately see that there has to be a fixed point which occurs at some lambda, which is non-zero, if D is larger than 2 alpha. So D larger than 2 alpha flow generally looks like this. If this is E and this is lambda, there has to be a fixed point here. Lambda C is a flow away from this point, flow beyond this point. And now E is also a relevant perturbation, which flows away from lambda C. The only thing is that from what I wrote, it looks like E equal to 0 is the critical point. But there's actually more terms on the right-hand side, which can shift E away from 0. And so there will be some EC here, where the critical point really occurs. And so the flow will be more like this, away from this critical point. And so that's the critical point which controls this physics. Okay, and then you can study, well, you can define two critical exponents, one having to do with lambda flow, one having to do with E flow, and these are obviously nu and z.
Right, but there's another critical point, right?
Where?
At lambda equals zero.
Ah, right.
Yeah, so that's a...
Yes, absolutely.
...unstable direction, so you should have the flows coming...
That's the critical point. That's a trivial Gaussian point. And this normalization group is derived by expanding about this point in the hopes that 2 alpha minus d is not too large, so in the spirit of epsilon expansion. So if 2 alpha minus d is small, this lambda c will be small, and then we can study it by looking at these RG equations.
But if you accept that diagram, and if you move in energy for lambda less than lambda c, there is a transition controlled by the Gaussian.
That's right, yes. a good question is how to study it and what are its applications.
You might have thought that that would give rise to singularity in the density of states and a divergence of the mean free path.
Yes, in the sense that if disorder is zero, density of states is singular at the origin.
Yeah, and usually
that's this point.
So usually when you have an irrelevant operator, I mean, you can do perturbation theory in it, and it doesn't change universal energy properties.
You can do this. That's right. Yeah. Right. And actually, if you look in our paper, we do this in our paper.
But so you told us before the density of states was smooth for lambda less than lambda c.
Well, but for any finite lambda less than lambda c.
Mm-hmm. So how do I resolve the picture though?
I think there is a range of energies. It's a good question to which the exact answer I don't remember, but it is contained, I think, in the first paper out of these three. I think you cannot go all the way down to zero energy if this order is small but finite. So, in other words, there will be some range of energies where the spectrum will look, well, or density of states will look like this order free density of states. But if this order is, when this order is weak, but you should be able still to continue this density of state all the way to minus infinity and see Lipschitz tails.
That's a different question. That's a different question, right? So that this kind of RG flow would suggest that you should have the same universal singularities at fixed but small lambda as you do at lambda equals zero. Doesn't mean you don't have some smooth parts away from that.
So you are saying we would imagine that there is some additional singularity at E equal to zero at weak disorder.
Which there at zero disorder there is, and there's this E to the D over 2 minus 1 singularity in the density of states. Is that
okay?
Not?
It sounds reasonable, and we do discuss this in our paper, but I don't remember what was said about this. It could well be that this is what was said, but I have to look at our paper. But I see your point is probably right.
The same question goes for the mean free path. So I would have thought again that as I pass through this energy where the singularity happens,
right.
The mean free path would diverge.
Yes, but that's absolutely true, and you could just compute it, and you'll see that it diverges as disorder strength goes to zero.
But I'm saying for fixed disorder strength at some energy, the energy which in your phase diagram where you cross the separatrix, which flows into that.
But that flows into some other point, right?
No. There should be a. Whenever you have it. So that point is like the usual critical point in the phase space. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's one relevant direction.
So you'd like to go in this direction.
There should be a line,
right?
There should be some stable line which flows into it, which would be going from your bicritical point, which has two unstable directions, coming into that one.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
That would be the normally be the separatrix.
So that's what you're talking about.
No.
You've drawn it. Maybe I can edit.
You fix.
I mean,
you fix this order.
The bottom line is a bit is deceptive, right? Because you told us this point shifts in energy.
Uh huh. Right.
So you would think normally you would say this.
Yes, absolutely.
Look like this, and then the line. And that other flow is actually do something like this.
Okay, I see what you mean. Right, yeah, that's what I meant, right, but I just didn't draw this line, right.
So when you cross that line, I would have thought that would be the... At least if you do self-consistent Born approximation, or it's not even self-consistent, just Born approximation, you would get, I think, a diverging mean free path at that energy.
It's probably true, right? When you this will be some sort of effect from approaching the bottom of the band in your calculation.
Yeah.
And you will see that version, right?
Because there's very little density. Yes. The physics why the thing is irrelevant is a very little density of states at the band bottom, so it's hard to scatter. So then the mean free path kind of scattering rate vanishes faster than the velocity does as you approach the band bottom.
Mm-hmm. Well, all of this sounds very much like what we discussed at the time, but before this talk, I didn't look this up, so I cannot immediately tell you that that's what was said. And that's a long paper. We said lots of things in that paper, including what happens in the vicinity of this point. But, well, yeah, it all sounds reasonable. Right. Okay. So, let's see. What else can I say about this issues. Well, we can study this point using epsilon expansion. And what does it mean using epsilon expansion? Saying that 2 alpha minus d is small enough where the critical point lambda c is sufficiently small so this expansion works. And so this lambda c is given by d minus 2 alpha divided by this coefficient c. And so that allows you to deduce from here that the exponent z, well, actually, let me first give you exponent nu. So exponent nu is the slope of an annihilation group at lambda c. And so that's given by d minus 2 alpha, actually 1 over d minus 2 alpha. That's, of course, all epsilon expansion based results. It's only valid when d is close enough to 2 alpha. So for a five-dimensional Schrodinger equation, that nu is 1, but how close it is to the actual value is anybody's guess, because nobody has done numerics, and this is just one loop, Rg. And then you can also compute the exponent z, which is essentially this thing with lambda c substituted. And so z is alpha plus beta lambda c. Yes, and so you can see that the value of z depends on the ratio of beta and c. So this ratio then plays an important role of what z is. Okay, and so finally, once I said this, these pictures become somewhat more clear. So this is nothing but just the claim that since this Green's function is controlled by critical field theory, it should have this kind of scaling given here. And so that follows essentially immediately from appreciating what these critical exponents are and what the definition of exponent z is. And now, as far as this picture, this requires a little bit of reasoning going above just this analysis. So we have to say that localization length would be extracted from the products of advanced and retarded Green's functions, which I also describe by some theory, but you have to double the number of fields and describe advanced and retarded sector. But the normalization group equations are not affected by the number of sectors. So these equations remain exactly the same, no matter how many sectors you have. And so then you still have this critical point. And then if lambda is larger than lambda c, you argue that this theory is non-critical. If lambda is larger than lambda c, then lambda just flows to strong values. And once it does, you should apply the same logic you normally apply to the disordered Schrodinger equation below 4 dimensions, which is Schrodinger-derived sigma model, which you normally do below 4 dimensions when lambda is just relevant. And then sigma model will predict for you that there is a transition here given by this formula with Anderson exponent independent of the disorder strength. But if lambda is equal to lambda c, we have a divergent length in the problem, which is not a localization length. It already occurs in a single particle Green's function. And so we think it's a mean-free path. And localization length at least is bounded by that length. And unless localization length diverges faster than this length, which maybe happens, but it would be strange to expect this. That would mean that we have two separate length scales in a theory which involves both advanced and retarded Green's functions. So we don't think that happens. In that case, localization length diverges in the same way how mean-free path diverges, and then it's given by this formula written here with an exponent, which is 1 over z, where z is given by this formula. And finally, if lambda is less than lambda c, situation is far less clear. It's just because it's not clear how to do an analysis of what happens when you have irrelevant disorder strength and what it implies for localization length and for localization transition in general. So one thing which you can argue is that the states deep at large negative energies, that these states will be localized. In fact, you can repeat the analysis of Lipschitz tail states, which becomes somewhat different from the conventional analysis. Remember, the conventional formula which I erased had 2 minus d over 2 in it, which did something funny when d became larger than 4. So if you do the conventional analysis, you will see that fluctuations of disorder which support Lipschitz tail states are all very short-ranged. So these are fluctuations on the level of lattice spacing, which should support these Lipschitz tail states. And they provide for the density of states, which over a large interval is constant. So conventionally, you have exponentially decaying Lipschitz tail. But here, it's more like a constant Lipschitz tail states up to some cutoff having to do with lattice spacing. But in any case, those states, if they live at far negative energy, they will be localized. And so there has to be some kind of localization, delocalization transition. But exactly how it happens is something I don't know. And like I said, that's something which we don't understand. Okay, but so I told you almost everything I know about disordered Schrodinger equation. And now I have a few more things to say about disordered Weyl equation. But I ran out of time, assuming I should be talking for 45 minutes. And I'm not sure what is best at this stage. I could stop altogether, or I can mention a few things about disordered Weyl problem. Well, basically what I prepared to talk about was this problem. And as it turns out, there's also an equivalent one-dimensional problem, which has essentially the same normalization group physics as a three-dimensional Weyl. And that's, I think, described in a second paper here. And
in 5 minutes, you can explain.
Let me try to do it in 5 minutes. Just because I'm using Blackboard, it always takes a little bit longer. It's not just showing a couple of slides and saying, okay, it's all on these slides. All right, so let me try now to tell you what happens when you have a Weyl problem. So the Weyl problem looks very much like this problem. So it has spectrum alpha equal to 1, but it has a dimensionality of space 3, which is bigger than 2 alpha. So we should expect to see some signatures of this physics. But Weyl problem, as defined here, has nice symmetry e to minus e. So from this symmetry alone, you expect that EC will be 0. And all the numerical calculations confirm that EC is 0. And so then what you expect in this problem to happen, from what we just learned, is that the density of states is a function of energy. Well, so without disorder, it'll be quadratic. It's just e squared. It's a three-dimensional problem. Right. But now, if I add disorder, well, this thing will remain smooth, but it'll change its shape. But exactly at lambda equal to lambda c, so that's at lambda equal to 0. But at lambda equal to lambda c, it'll develop a cusp again. And now what's really interesting is that all the numerical studies of this problem indicate that the spectrum of rho as a function of E looks very much linear to pretty high accuracy. So if rho as a function of E at lambda equal to lambda C is linear, that would imply that exponent Z is exactly D over 2. That's what follows from here. And now if you look at these epsilon expansion calculations, you will see that, rather interestingly, the one loop epsilon expansion predicts that Z is exactly alpha over 2 for this problem, but not for this one. So the only difference between disordered Schrodinger equation and disordered Weyl problem is that it has different values of beta and C coefficients. You have to work out what they are. They take specific value for the Schrodinger equation and some other value for the Weyl problem. And with further analysis, you can actually show that these coefficients are sensitive not so much to the matrix structure of this problem, but rather to the fact that it's symmetric under E goes to minus E. So the clean spectrum of this problem has a symmetry. You reflect E to minus E and rho remains the same, while for the Schrodinger equation, it does not have this symmetry. And so it appears that as a result of that symmetry, coefficients C and beta change in such a way that if you calculate Z in one loop, the contribution proportional to D minus 2 epsilon, the first correction, somehow cancels and D becomes exactly D over 2. But there is no reason to expect that this persists beyond one loop. Nevertheless, numerics somehow is compatible with Z equal to D over 2. Now, there were some papers from Sankar Dasarma group which said that Z is exactly D over 2, but he also has some other papers which derive corrections to D in the two-loop calculation where that correction was not 0, and so there's no agreement here between these approaches, and I would say the question is still open. Now, if lambda is larger than lambda C, we expect some generic smooth density of states, and that's what numerics sees. Another interesting aspect of this is that you see, numerics all predict that the density of states at 0 is equal to 0 if lambda is less than lambda C. It only becomes non-zero when lambda is larger than lambda c. But you can give argument that that cannot be true, because, for example, you expect to have some kind of density of states at zero energy at any amount of disorder, if simply because there should be rare fluctuations where disorder shifts uniformly over some large volume by some amount, and that should produce states at zero energy for this type of Dirac problem, no matter what disorder strength is. But somehow numerics doesn't see it. So, these are two questions which I think are not completely resolved. So one question is, at lambda equal to lambda c, rho is e to the power of d over z minus 1. And the question is z equal to d over 2? So one loop rg gives you d over 2. You can also do some kind of large n calculation in which d is also exactly d over 2. And in fact, that was done by Frotkin in his original paper. He did this large n type calculation, and z was z over 2 exactly for him. But nobody knows if it's true more generally. But numeric somehow is compatible with d being d over 2. And second question, if lambda is equal to lambda c, rho of 0 should be greater than 0. But this is not seen numerically. But there is a paper by Hughes, Sondi, and Nankishore who actually discuss what rho of 0 is based on Lipschitz-Tail-like arguments of large fluctuations. And obviously, they get something which is not 0. And that's still the remaining question. And so let me use up another minute, and since I came to this point, and gave you a separate model which was studied in the very last paper of that list, which seemed to reproduce a lot of physics of these wild fermions. So it's a problem of a one-dimensional Schrodinger equation with the Hamiltonian given by some over points in space of some kind of Hopping matrix elements of a particle hopping from points x prime to x with on-site disorder, where Hopping matrix elements are designed to be I divided by x minus x prime to the power of 1 plus alpha sine x minus x prime. And that's why I is there to make the Hamiltonian Hermitian. So if there is no disorder, if lambda, which controls disorder strength, is set to 0 here, the strength of this guy, then the spectrum of this problem is absolute value k to the alpha sine k. And depending on the alpha, it essentially has a density of states which looks very much like density of states of Weyl problem. Now, if you turn on disorder, if alpha is less than 1/2, that's precisely the condition for the dimension of space to be larger. And dimensional space is 1. It's a one-dimensional problem. So that's the condition for disorder to be irrelevant. So if alpha is less than 1/2, then disorder is irrelevant because it's larger than 2 alpha. You can derive renormalization group equations, and they'll look exactly the same, at least in one loop, as they look for this problem. And that's part of the basis of the claim that as long as you have the spectrum, which is symmetric under e goes to minus e, you actually get that type of renormalization group equations. Interestingly, if you don't put sine here and you don't get sine here, you'll get the same renormalization group equation as for disorder Schrodinger equation. Well, not surprisingly, because it doesn't map into a class of problems. But anyway, so this particular problem mimics this one. As long as alpha is less than 1/2, and you can study the density of states numerically, and it looks exactly like this, with the spectrum at the transition point looking, within your numerics, it looks very much linear. Even though, again, there is no reason here to believe that z is exactly 1/2, which is d over 2 in this case. And here you actually have control over epsilon parameter, which is 1 minus 2 alpha. So in the Weyl problem, or in the Schrodinger equation in 5 dimensions, this epsilon is of the order of 1. But here, if you take your alpha close to 1/2, you can play with it. You can make it smaller or larger, make one loop RG to be better, worse approximation. But nevertheless, this line all looks linear. OK. And so the very last thing which I'll say then is that so all of these properties of the density of states that are very useful if you try to study transport properties of wild semi-metals. So this problem is famous for being in three dimensions but not having any Anderson localization. And that's because this formula looks like the boundary of a four-dimensional topological insulator. And so everything here is delocalized. Nevertheless, we should be able to identify two phases, lambda less than lambda c, lambda larger than lambda c, those density of states being critical at lambda equal to lambda c, very much according to this formula, but with the symmetry e to minus e. And so that feeds into identification of what it means, you know, for these two phases and what kind of conductivity and conductances we get in these two phases. Many of these questions are still not completely clear and are still debated. One of these papers here, I think, contributes to these questions, but explaining these questions will take me another half an hour, so I'm not going to do this. But that was not my goal. So my goal was just to give a general overview of what I expect from localization physics in dimensions above this upper critical dimension, which is 2 alpha, twice the power in the Hamiltonian, and how it actually translates into something which people study these days in the context of disordered wild semi-metals. But I think I said enough, and I spoke for an hour, so I should stop.
Any more questions?
Yeah, I'm just wondering about this higher-order corrections to this g equal d over 2 or not.
Uh-huh.
So I know some examples when you have some long-range stuff like that, like the one you wrote here. What happens in the RG equations is that the intrinsic normalization of the Kepling constants is finite. So there is a, because of the long-range thing, and so there is a then an exact relation between the beta function and the normalization of the mass. So you can, even though the beta function has corrections to all orders, the critical exponent is, you can derive the critical exponent exactly in intermediate. So maybe, I don't know, maybe it's a
case. Maybe there is something.
I can give you a reference on
that. Okay, that would be interesting. So notice that
it happens when there's long-range things. Because the beta function has two terms, right? There's one term that comes from the normalization of the four-point thing, and another one from the wave function normalization.
Okay, right.
So when the wave function, when the G form is finite for normalization, then there is this exact relation that pops up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Okay, so maybe it helps. Interestingly, though, this problem does not have any long-range terms.
Yeah, I understand.
It's one loop RG matches one loop RG from this guy.
So maybe it's easier
okay,
to understand
but maybe
in that
on this case. On this level it could be understood, right? Okay, well that would be interesting to look at.
Yeah. So my fermion has a property that is free form backscattering.
Mm-hmm.
That property plays no role here.
That property
plays no role here.
In the one dimensional problem?
No, no,
three-dimensional
why.
Or here?
In this transition.
In this transition. Right. So that property plays no role in that transition, at least for the existence of that transition. But if you want to, well, I should make two comments on this. One of them is if you would like to make further or derive further consequences of the existence of this transition, whether you have no backscattering or not plays a big role. So for example, here in the five-dimensional Schrodinger equation, you have a transition that manifests itself in the new universality class of Anderson transition. Here, that doesn't happen because there's no localization. But you have to take one more step and interpret it in this way. Right? I mean, you don't need to know this to just understand what happens to the density of states. But I should also note that this model as written here also does not have localization transition. Well, it's in one dimensions and it's long range, but on top of it, it's chiral. Everything moves in the same direction. And so because of this, it does not have Anderson localization. It doesn't have backscattering. And so that problem also has this property. Although the analog of this problem with backscattering would still not have Anderson transition just because it's in one dimension. And so how much of a role it plays in the matching of this problem was that one, I don't know, but they do both have this property.
Yeah.
that there is absence of any kind of interesting transition or any kind of localization physics. Localization physics is in some sense trivial.
Yeah, so I just want to make one comment. Actually, those wild cell metals we are discussing in these days, they do have backscatterings because they are three-dimensional material. And those crossing points, the wild points, is not located at the high symmetry point like gamma point. So they do have very strong, maybe very strong backscattering terms.
But you're talking about do I understand it right that you are talking about several wild cones and there is a scattering between them?
Right.
Yes.
No. Even within one wild cone, there's no protection at all. So this minus k can scatter to plus k. Yeah, they have all kinds of backscattering.
Well, I would say though that
because this k, the crossing point is not located at gamma point or any high symmetry points. That's located at some arbitrary k point.
Okay.
Right.
But one thing I do know is that this model, as written here, if I just think in terms of a model, let's not think about its lattice. This will never localize.
Yeah, they have a high symmetry, which do not exist in real material. Yeah.
So I know that people do study implication of this for real materials, and they do study Anderson transition in addition to this kind of transition. Which actually makes things even more complicated because now we have two different transitions which occur generally at two different, not only values of disorder, but you have different classes of disorder. One of them induces one transition, one induces the other. And I think this kind of studies are not particularly useful unless you apply them to specific materials. So some of these papers which I think is too general because then you have these phase diagrams which become very complicated and without specific reference, they're not very meaningful. But for specific materials, yes, all of this will occur and is worth studying.
So you could force the set question of one approximation in the Gibbs motion, just break stuff as you approach lambda equals to lambda c.
Well, you can do self-consistent Born approximation, and that was what Fratkin did originally.
Yes.
And you can actually formulate a model, some sort of large-end generalization of these models, for which self-consistent Born approximation will be exact. And actually, what self-consistent Born approximation will give you, I mean, you will be able to solve these equations, and it'll tell you that, basically it'll give you this picture. It'll tell you that density of states at zero, if lambda is less than lambda c, I should maybe even add this here. Just let me say it in words because it's not written on the board. So density of states at zero energy for this problem, if lambda is less than lambda c, according to self-consistent Born approximation, is exactly zero, up to lambda equal to lambda c. And then it starts deviating from zero. And exactly at lambda equal to lambda c, as a function of energy, density of states vanishes linearly according to self-consistent Born approximation. So both of these equations can be answered in this way. Now, we believe that it's an artifact of self-consistent Born approximation. And then in general, density of states should have finite contribution at zero energy, and it should not be exactly linear at the transition points. But numeric somehow gives you something which looks very much like self-consistent Born approximation. And so there's some discrepancy which is not understood. And so I believe that it's just numerics needs to be done on larger system size to see this. But we now have this one-dimensional numerics, which does the same thing, also matches self-consistent Born. And it's easier to do one-dimensional numerics. So I don't completely understand the origin of this discrepancy.
OK, so there's another question. I'd like to close the session. I'd like to thank Victor.